Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. The Gospel of Judas is the topic for the next half hour of the program. I don't know when I first heard about it. I thought it was a joke. Now, some people's reaction has been far more serious. We've done a number of programs on the whole genre of literature that includes the Gospel of Judas, and it was a publishing sensation this last summer, probably largely due to the fact that Dan Brown's book and film were providing some coattails for the thing. But it's a serious question, and we're going to delve into it in the next half hour of Issues, etc. Before we get started on that conversation with Dr. Nicholas Perrin, contrast, if you would, picking up off our conversation with Uwe Simonetto, contrast, if you would, the reaction in the Muslim world to tragedy versus the reaction among Christians to tragedy. Now, you might think when we talk about LCMS World Relief that we're talking about a relief organization that targets Christians for relief, that worries only about Christians for relief. That is not true. Places like the Sudan, LCMS World Relief is helping Christians, Muslims, whoever they may be, bringing that touch of mercy and its concern for both body and soul. For more information on LCMS World Relief and what they're doing worldwide, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call them toll-free, 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438.
Let the record show I got the number right this time.
Yes, you did get the number right this time, although you're very difficult to understand. That's startling when I see you talking into that thing. Your voice is coming out right in front of me. I'm startled.
I'll bring Justin's walkie-talkies tomorrow. We'll see which one works better.
Or the baby monitor. That would work fine, too. Yeah. We shall see. Joining us to talk about the Gospel of Judas, Dr. Nicholas Perrin. He's assistant professor of New Testament at Wheaton College. Dr. Perrin formerly served as a research assistant to N.T. Wright. That's no small feat in itself. And he's author of the book titled The Judas Gospel. Dr. Perrin, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you, Todd.
How would you respond to a Christian who says, look, I've heard all about that Gospel of Judas, and maybe we talked about it in Bible class, but I'm not going to worry my pretty little head over those things. I've got Jesus in my heart, and that's all that counts. I don't need to worry about the Gospel of Judas.
Well, Todd, the fact is we do have to worry about the Gospel of Judas and any other gospel that has come up or will come up, because Christianity, if it's anything, it's a historical religion. In other words, we depend on texts, texts written by the Apostle Paul, texts written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And if we, on the one hand, want to say, oh, well, we just know that Jesus simply because he's in our heart, and yet we're not willing to be historians, that is, to test and verify what we actually believe has grounding in history, well, that's not very strong faith at the end of the day.
Give us a little history, as much as we have it, on the Gospel of Judas. When is the very first time in history that we are aware of its existence?
The first one to mention the Gospel of Judas, as far as we are aware, is Irenaeus, who was Bishop of Lyon in South France at the end of the 2nd century. So he mentions the Gospel of Judas in passing. He gave himself to studying the different heresies in order to refute them, and tantalizingly, he only has a few lines about the Gospel of Judas. It would have been great had he said more, but he does say a few things here and there.
What's his assessment of it? I mean, for Irenaeus is someone whose advice is probably best to follow first. What does he know of it, and what does he suggest about it?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, he ties it in with a sect that we know existed called the Canaanites, who saw a secret line of knowledge tracing itself all the way back to Cain. He also says that in this Gospel of Judas, the one he had access to, which we can't know, but I presume is the same Gospel of Judas that we have, that Judas was a traitor who alone had knowledge of the truth and knew what he was doing as far as betraying Jesus, and that it was a good thing.
So is this, since we have late 2nd century attestation to its existence, mm-hmm. is the Gospel of Judas then among the earliest of the false Gospels?
I would think it is one of the earliest of the false Gospels. Some of the non-canonical Gospels, and by canonical I mean Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and so when I use the term non-canonical, I mean any Gospel but Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We do know that there's some other non-canonical Gospels in existence, for example, the Gospel of the Ebionites, the Gospel of the Hebrews, Gospel of the Nazarenes, which may have been around as early as, say, the 120s or the 130s. Gospel of Judas may have been written as early as a few decades after that, but given that a number of these other Gospels, for example, the Gospel of Philip, is in the 3rd century, then this would put Gospel of Judas on the earlier end.
What's its provenance, as they say, from that point on?
Well, you mean what happens to it in history?
Yeah, what happens to it? Where does it pop up again?
Well, I mean, really, after the time of Irenaeus, it's gone. And what probably happened is the church, when it found copies of the Gospel of Judas, knew what to do with it and burned it. And, I mean, we've lost a good number of these other Gospels, for example, the Ebionites, probably because the Orthodox folk just said, well, if this, you know, we keep this stuff around, people start using it again, we don't want that. So there was an attempt to get rid of it and suppress it in order not to confuse people. But then, again, it just turns up in modern times when it was recently rediscovered.
What would someone be looking at if they actually saw the copies of the Gospel of Judas as they exist today? What would they see if they were looking at one of these things?
Well, in the text that we have, the Gospel of Judas comes to us in a codex. That's in a book. It occupies, I'm forgetting how many pages it occupies in this particular codex, but it's one text out of a number. And so the book was leather-bound, written on papyri sheets.
So it looks roughly like a modern book.
Yeah, but basically. The codex, the book, was really a Christian invention, to be honest, and it started becoming more and more popular starting in the 2nd century. And so the Gospel of Judas, the copy that we have was probably produced, sometime in the 3rd century, and that's based on radiocarbon dating. The original, that copy is based on original that probably was written down, in the middle of the 2nd century, that is 150s, 160s, or thereabouts.
What are the connections between the Gospel of Judas and the ancient heresy of Gnosticism?
Well, I do see the Gospel of Judas as a Gnostic text. I think most scholars would agree with that. Many of the themes that come up in the Gospel of Judas are very common to the so-called Gnostic texts. One particular important theme is the theme of Doceticism. Doceticism, or if you were Docetic, that basically meant that, you might have a high opinion of Jesus. You might even say that Jesus was God, but you simply, flatly refuse to believe that Jesus was flesh if he was God. The Docetics, which the church fought long and hard for many centuries, down to the Nicene Creed and beyond, the Docetics were quite willing to say very high things about Jesus, but they really choked on the notion that God could become flesh. And in the Gospel of Judas, one thing that really sticks out is this very low view of the flesh.
So what's the basic outline story or premise that's at work in the Gospel of Judas for those who haven't read about it or read it?
Well, it's hard to make out a plot line, and part of the reason for that is because we do have large gaps in the text. But what seems to be happening in the Gospel of Judas is that Judas is very favorably compared with the other disciples. So there's a number of scenes in which Judas is talking with Jesus, sometimes with the other disciples there, sometimes he's in private with Jesus. And at points, Jesus has to straighten Judas out here or there, but the underlying hint is that you, Judas, alone of all the disciples, really understand what's going on. And the other disciples, the apostles, are out to lunch and are leading people astray. So, and then the climax is when Jesus turns to Judas and says, well, you're going to turn me in, and it's a good thing. You're going to get rid of the flesh that is keeping me back.
So this ties together with what you mentioned before. Jesus being a Gnostic, according to this scenario, views the material world as a hindrance to his spiritual progression.
Right.
And he enlists Judas in a secret plot to have him killed.
Right.
So that he can escape this mortal coil.
Right, right. So literally Jesus says, you will sacrifice the man that clothes me. In other words, he describes his flesh or his humanity like a garment that he can, you just take off. So once Judas turns Jesus in, Jesus can finally be free of his humanity, which for him was obviously a drag. And this stands quite contrast to the way we Orthodox people look at Jesus, and that is that his humanity is part and parcel of who he was and something to be celebrated.
So how does Jesus come off? How is he depicted in the Gospel of Judas?
It's interesting. In almost every Gnostic text, Jesus comes off as kind of a hero. The different Gnostic texts will sometimes see Jesus as kind of a guru, where, for example, in the Gospel of Thomas, we can attain to the same status that Jesus has by entering into the right activities or aspiring for enlightenment. Here, I think Jesus, in the Gospel of Judas, Jesus is depicted as being an emanation from the true God, but not one and the same as the true God himself. So Jesus is up there, but he's not quite to the top.
Is there any parallel to the passion accounts in the canonical Gospels, in the Gospel of Judas?
Well, you know, what's interesting is sometimes you do have little bits and parallels there. So I have to think that the author of the Gospel of Judas had access to the canonical Gospels. For example, there's mention of a guest room, and the word in Greek is katalima, which occurs, for example, in the Gospel of Luke, when Jesus arranges for his Passover meal. He says, okay, you know, get it all together, and then they meet in the kataluma, the guest room. And in the Gospel of Judas, Jesus is tied in with this same guest room, but there's no, I mean, it's interesting, the Gospel of Judas just cuts it short, and I suppose you're supposed to know the ending. I think the implication is you know how it turns out.
So in many ways, this is a document consciously written to put a decidedly different spin on what would have been familiar events to the reader.
Yes, that's right, and that's an important point to bring up with people. For example, I was just astonished when Elaine Pagels of Princeton comes out and says, you know, this gives us as good, she suggests as much, that this gives us as good a window into the historical Jesus as we have anywhere else. But the fact of the matter is, you read the Gospel of Judas, it's clearly derivative and dependent on the canonical Gospels. And so there's a remove on the sense of using Christian canonical texts, but there's also this sense that it's a conscious attempt to rebel against Orthodox Christianity as it's laid out in the canonical Gospels. In other words, it would be impossible to write the Gospel of Judas if Orthodox Christianity wasn't already in place.
And that kind of flies in the face of the premise of much of Pagel's thought and others who have suggested that early Christianity was theologically in flux, that there was no decided or settled doctrine. It was a bunch of different ideas all vying for prominence.
Well, that's right, and she is a great popularizer of that idea. And the way she gets there, and she's not alone, Bart Ehrman has taken a very similar track, the way they get there is some kind of combination of a very late dating for the canonical Gospels and a very early dating for the non-canonical Gospels.
Why are they willing, Pagels and Ehrman, we've interviewed Ehrman after his latest book, very interesting to see the way his mind works, but why do these intelligent people like Pagels and Ehrman, why do they question the reliability of the canonical Gospels and then fail to question the reliability of these alternate false Gospels?
Well, that's that's a million-dollar question. I mean, what Ehrman and Pagels and Helmut Kester of Harvard would ask of conservative believers is, well, why is it that you believe everything Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John say at face value? Well, we can simply turn that around and say, well, why are you so incredulous in regards to the canonical Gospels, but so uncritical and so credulous in regards to the non-canonical Gospels? It's amazing, too. Some of these same scholars will say the Gospel of Thomas, for example, goes back to Thomas when they would never dream of saying the Gospel of Matthew goes back to Matthew or Mark goes back to Mark or Luke goes back to Luke.
We're talking about the Gospel of Judas. Dr. Nicholas Perrin is our guest, assistant professor of New Testament at Wheaton College. He formerly served as a research assistant to N.T. Wright, and he's author of the new booklet titled The Judas Gospel. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. If you have a question or a comment on the Gospel of Judas, give us a call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, or send us your email right here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. How does Judas come off in the Gospel of Judas?
Judas comes off slightly mixed. I mean, he's slightly muddled here and there. As I mentioned, Jesus has to steer him straight here and there. Jesus says to Judas, your star has misguided you here or there. But at the end of the day, Judas, and Judas alone, is the one who gets it. And so the way Judas comes off is really the one and only person in the universe who understands what Jesus was about. And so if you are privy to this Gospel of Judas, you get to share in Judas's very special knowledge.
Now, you mentioned before that this sense of docetism, that is, that Jesus only appeared to be human but was some sort of divine figure, seems to be strong in the Gospel of Judas.
Mm-hmm.
You also say that Judas is an anti-Jewish character. What do you mean by that?
Well, much of Gnosticism is very anti-Jewish, and I think here's the reason why. There may have been sociological factors for some of the anti-Semiticism and Gnosticism. In other words, in Syria, for example, where we see Marcionism really take off, although Marcion developed his views in Rome, they were exported to the eastern part of the empire in Syria, where they attracted a huge following. There seems to have been a lot of envy of the financial success of the Jews, and so perhaps there were some kind of sociological reasons for why people weren't happy with Judaism. But on a philosophical or theological level, even some Jews were, became Gnostic. Because why? Because they couldn't square the notion of a creator God also being a good God. If you lived in the first century or in the second century, you knew your Plato, that is the philosopher Plato, and Plato was in your blood, and just by instinct you began to think, well, if something's true, it's got to be unchangeable, it's got to be eternal, and therefore it can't be physical. So it was so terribly difficult for people to get their heads around the idea that physical things could also be good things. So for a Gnostic and for someone who's docetic, the whole idea of a created universe was someone's idea of a big, sick joke. And that's why, and it's sad in some ways that this same kind of thinking infiltrates our church, too, when in fact, in biblical thinking, creation is always good.
Jeff calls from Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. Jeff, thanks for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, guys. I think a small correction regarding Bart Ehrman. I heard a lecture he gave regarding the Da Vinci Code, and I think he would just classify himself as probably equally skeptical. I think Pagels gives more credence to the Gnostic Gospels. But I think one of the things I think they kind of miss is that, I mean, if you read the early apostolic fathers who knew the apostles like John or Polycarp or other people, they're quoting the New Testament scriptures left and right. They are not even quoting, there's nowhere, no mention of the Gnostic Gospels at all. And I think in the secular realm that's kind of missed or maybe willfully missed or subconsciously missed or something along those lines.
Jeff, thank you very much. Thanks for listening out there in Pennsylvania, too. Your response?
Yeah, that's a good comment. I mean, I do want to be fair to Bart because he actually, as far as the Da Vinci Code goes, I think he's...
He debunks it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And pretty much I agree with 95% of what he says. So I probably shouldn't lump in Bart with Elaine Pagels. I mean, I do think Pagels and April DeConnick, for example, down at Wesleyan, Illinois Wesleyan, takes a rather extreme approach. So not everything the airman says is wacky and off the wall, but there is a kind of tendency to apply this hermeneutic of suspicion that's not evenly applied. And Jeff's point is true that in the early church fathers, we do see citations of the scriptural texts. Pagel's counterargument to that would be, well, of course, but they're part of the proto-Orthodox crowd, and all the other folks have just been suppressed.
Finally, why wasn't the Gospel of Judas, since it does exist so early, why doesn't the church include it in the canon of the New Testament? Bottom line for our listeners.
Bottom line, the Gospel of Judas didn't end up in the canon, and no one would ever think of putting it in the canon for, I mean, a number of reasons. But when I talk about the canonization of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were accepted as authoritative and used in the church. We know that they were used at the time of Justin Martyr in the mid-2nd century. He calls them memoirs. He doesn't call them Gospels. But he talks about the Gospels and their use in church as just being standard. This is what we do. This is borne out by Irenaeus 30 years later. So the early church from very, very early on used four Gospels and only four. And secondarily, you look at the four Gospels and they give a coherent picture of Jesus that stands greatly at odds with the kind of Jesus you find in the Gospel of Judas.
Dr. Nicholas Perrin is assistant professor of New Testament at Wheaton College, served as research assistant for N.T. Wright, and authors the new booklet titled The Judas Gospel. Dr. Perrin, thanks for being our guest.
Okay, Todd, thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Well, when we come back, we're halfway through the show today. Bob Liko is going to join us. It is a standard claim in charismatic circles that signs and wonders and miracles create faith. Do the charismatics have it right? We'll answer that question with Bob Liko on the other side of this break, a half hour's conversation with him, and then in hour three, we'll check in briefly with Doug Johnson of National Right to Life. He'll bring us up to date on yesterday's House passage of the Parental Interstate Abortion Notification Bill. This is their second bite at the apple of this thing. Does it have a chance in the Senate? This would be a national parental notification bill. It would be a good thing to happen from my perspective as a pro-lifer. Doug Johnson will tell us what's in store for this bill since it passed the House yesterday. And then we've got audio open lines for your questions and your comments. If you were watching O'Reilly last night, you saw one of his guests, Bill Maher, spout off on religion. He says it's akin to psychosis. What I want to do is play that for you at about 5:15. And then I just want your reaction. And what the kind of reaction I'm looking for is this. I want a thinking, considered reaction to Bill Maher's comments on O'Reilly last night. Stay tuned.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What makes this such a unique place is that the Word of God is so central and is proclaimed with such vigor and such clarity at this place.
Dr. Larry Rast on the uniqueness of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Here the scriptures are at the center. The Lutheran confessions as a right exposition of the scriptures are held up for all the world to hear. Here we are concerned about our historical past and being faithful to the proclamation of the gospel as the scriptures give them to us and as the faithful church has delivered those over time. And also we are concerned about preparing servants for the church, pastors who will preach the word and administer the sacrament. So what you have is a community with Christ at the center of all things. And as such, that truly makes this a unique place.
Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. For many parents, when their child asks to go to the movies, the first question is, what's in the film they want to see? Is there sex, violence, or bad language? Some may go so far as to buy edited movies, with all the objectionable stuff taken out. Hollywood calls that a violation of their freedom of expression. Congress calls it a reason to look for a legal solution. Kim Troby has the story.
A recent court ruling made it illegal for companies to edit the sex and violence out of movies and resell them, even though they've paid royalties to the studios. Congressman Joe Barton thinks that leaves parents out.
I believe technology can provide a solution that will satisfy the rights, both financial and artistic, of content producers, as well as provide parents with the control they deserve over the content they purchase for family viewing in their own homes.
One suggestion was Hollywood should create a new market for the edited versions. Jason Schultz, an attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, can't understand why the entertainment industry wouldn't want to sell clean movies.
Quite honestly, the Motion Picture Association had no answers.
He says their rights have not been violated because their products have not been banned, just altered slightly. Another answer may be for Congress to expand existing laws to cover editing companies, but that doesn't rule out the possibility of new legislation.
If parents want lots of choices to customize their movie watching experience, then yeah, Congress is going to have to do some work.
In the meantime, Clean Flicks and Clean Films, companies that specialize in removing offensive content from movies, can no longer offer their services to the hundreds of thousands of parents willing to pay extra money for their versions. For Family News in Focus, I'm Kim Troby.
Another solution is ClearPlay. The company offers advanced parental controls for DVD players, TVs, and other technology that filters out sex, violence, and language from movies and videos. Parents can program in their preferences. Right now, it's the only product of its kind on the market. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Dining with sinners. That's what happens every Sunday at Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. The Lord Jesus himself comes and spreads his banquet table before us, sinners, not a target group of professionals, but sinners in need of the one thing that only he can give, the forgiveness that he won for us at the cross. Christian, seeker, unbeliever, it doesn't matter. All those who are burdened by their sin and hungry for God's forgiveness are invited to visit Bethany Lutheran Church, 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights.
Our Issues Etc. book of the month for September is actually a CD and a booklet. It's titled Listening to Luther. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. The CD contains a recording of Luther's Small Catechism and hymns by Martin Luther. The booklet contains a history of the Small Catechism and several of Martin Luther's hymns, including the text. Listening to Luther, our Issues Etc. book of the month.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here at 4:30, Bob Liko is going to join us. We're going to be talking about miracles, signs, and wonders. Do they produce faith? I mean, I guess you could read the New Testament this way, those Gospels, and the book of Acts, where Jesus and his apostles do miracles, and it seems to wow the crowds. Is that what produces faith in the hearts of these people? What was the relationship, the real relationship between Jesus' many miracles and his proclamation of the gospel? We'll answer that question with Bob Liko here in this half hour of the program. In the third hour of the program, Doug Johnson of National Right to Life joins us. And then it's audio open lines. We're going to be playing that Bill Maher audio from Bill O'Reilly last night, where Bill O'Reilly very generously allowed Maher the chance to say on his air what CBS wouldn't let Maher say on their air about religion. And then I want your reaction to it. I'm just going to keep my mouth shut and let you call and let you react. But I want the reactions to be careful and considered. If you're like me, you watch Bill Maher. I don't watch him because he just makes me mad, okay? I used to think he was hilarious. He is actually a very funny guy. But when he turned political, and it's hard to laugh anymore, okay? Now, and I can put up with an awful lot of stuff like that. But I want you to think of it this way. After you've heard Maher there in the third hour, I want you to think of it this way. Rather than your knee-jerk reaction, I want to hear how you would respond to him. I'm going to leave it up to you. That's it. It's audio open lines there in the last hour of the program. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Bob Liko is a regular guest. He's co-founder of Discernment Ministry International, based in Detroit. He's author of an article in the latest issue of the Truth Matters newsletter titled, Do Miracle Signs and Wonders Create Faith? Bob, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Pastor Todd. How are you?
I'm doing well. Hey, Bob, say hello to Jeff. Jeff now has a still untested means of communicating with the rest of our listeners. So say hello to Jeff.
Grace and peace to you, Jeff.
Bob, I already talked to you.
Yeah, he did.
Oh, yeah, I forgot.
He sounded like the Lord there.
Hey, Todd. In case you didn't know, Todd, I actually called the guests.
Oh, you do? Is that what you're doing in there? I thought Craig was doing that.
It's a miracle. No, it's a miracle. The phone just rang, and here you are, and here I am. I mean, this is a perfect example of our topic.
Well, I'll tell you what.
It's a sign. It's a wonder.
It's a sign and a wonder.
I thought it was Radio Shack.
Yeah, maybe a little bit of Radio Shack, too. Maybe some of the signs and wonders that the signs and wonders people are doing has a little Radio Shack involved.
Yay.
All right, Bob, you came out of this, and you said if you heard it once, you heard it 1,000 times, that miracles are God's calling card. What did that mean in charismatic circles?
In the circles that we operated in, which were many, actually, but towards the end, many more on the extreme end, it simply meant that God used signs and wonders and miracles, and they divided those kind of up into three specific categories, which really in the Greek we can look at in a minute, they're really not. But that God used those to draw the lost to Christ. In other words, people are not simply going to believe anymore in the simple, simplistic preaching and proclamation of the gospel. In other words, just getting up and preaching the Bible is not going to get the job done. What people need is they need to see blind eyes open, deaf ears unstopped, the lame to walk again, and then you've got an audience. Then they're going to say, okay, I'm going to listen to what you have to say because obviously you have got some sort of divine power working here, and so your message must have some validity to it. And that's basically what it meant, and that's what has been taught and is being taught to this very day by many within the charismatic movement. Now, certainly not all, but many, especially within the prophetic and, shall we call it, the apostolic movement, you know, the whole signs and wonders movement out of Toronto and Pensacola and places like that, they really are pushing this concept very strongly today. But almost every major charismatic author and television personality has written books and has series of tapes out on how to obtain a miracle from God or obtain his miracle power or the gift of working of miracles. In fact, I'm looking right here on my desk, a New York Times bestselling author, Pat Robertson, entitled Miracles Can Be Yours Today. In fact, this book is personally autographed by Mr. Robertson to us. Brand new, 2006. Haven't read it yet. But that's what they meant, that miracles actually would lead people to Christ.
Is that how Christ and the apostles, is that how miracles functioned in their respective ministries?
Certainly not. In fact, in many times, Jesus would go about often, and the common occurrences throughout the four Gospels is that Jesus would preach and teach and then heal. So the proclamation of the gospel, the preaching of the Bible came first, and then if he indeed worked any signs and wonders or healed the sick, that came after. He didn't do that first and then say, okay, see, now I've done this, now I want you to listen to what I've got to say. No, he taught the Word of God first and preached the Word of God, and then some signs and wonders certainly followed. And there are a lot of, you know, scriptural examples we could certainly, quote for the listeners, if they want to look it up, they could start with Matthew 7, 28 and 29, the leper in the same book, Peter's mother-in-law. All of these we find, you know, they're examples of healing, really, and not so much miracles. And there is a little difference between divine healing and miracles. We certainly believe that Jesus heals the sick today. We believe that he does it according to his will, not on demand, but that he certainly heals people today. And healing I would not put in the same category as a miracle. Now, walking on water, raising the dead, something like that, that's a miracle.
Okay. This was a couple months ago. I was watching television late one night, and they were running one of David Blaine's specials. You know who David Blaine is, by any way?
Yes, I've seen him on TV.
He's a street illusionionist. You know, he used to call them magicians, but he does card tricks and he amazes people. And then he does things that are a little more difficult to explain, like levitating in the middle of the street.
Uh-huh.
And he's not afraid to have the cameras follow him around. I've seen him put his hand through a plate glass window and without it breaking, things like that just blow your mind. You sit there afterwards and you say, okay, the guy's either in league with the devil or he is one of the most clever illusionists ever in the world. But David Blaine doesn't explain himself. He doesn't attach any religious significance to it, but he does it for the cameras.
Right.
And if you ask him to do it on camera, he'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
If David Blaine can do it, why can't Benny Hinn do one of these kind of miracles that he claims is the cornerstone of his ministry, the kind that people, not just grandma walking up there saying, I got a pain back here, and then whoops, it's gone. We don't know whether grandma's telling the truth or not. Why not one that genuinely appears to be miraculous?
Well, that's the question that's been put to Mr. Hinn on numerous occasions, and I think there have been three documentaries, if you will, or interviews on camera about him, directly talking with him. He ceased to do those now. And that's always a question that comes up. And his answer is, I am not the healer. You know, Jesus is the one that does these things. And, you know, he chooses to use me at times. And I am amazed sometimes when he heals one person and doesn't heal another person. He says, you know, that's up to the Lord. So he kind of wiggles out of it that way. But I find it interesting that in our newsletter last month, we had a photocopy of one of the miracle passes we got as partners, in quotes, in his ministry. And, of course, he calls his meetings Miracle Crusades. And a lot of these traveling healers do that. And I'm always amazed by the hubris that it takes to say, you know, come out Friday night. The Lord is going to be working miracles. He's going to be opening the eyes of the blind, and the lame are going to walk, and the sick are going to be healed. How do they know? They don't command God. These things don't work like David Blaine, who I believe is simply a street magician, and I don't think he's in league with the devil necessarily. I just think he's a very clever guy. But, you know, Benny can't do this. In fact, there's James Randi, the former magician himself and atheist and skeptic, who has $1 million in the bank waiting for someone to come into a closed scientific environment and perform a miracle, and if they can, and it can be scientifically tested and proven, then they'll walk out with $1 million. But Oral Roberts and all the other people he's invited to come and, you know, heal someone or do something of this nature have refused to do it. And they fall back on, well, you know, you can't command God. Well, that's exactly what Benny Hinn and these other frauds do. I believe, in their so-called miracle crusades. They make many promises, but they're unfulfilled. And Hinn is on videotape as saying, well, at least I give people hope, because he was confronted with the fact of people that said they were healed who died just weeks later. And when he was told this, he said, well, I give people hope. And the cameraman's announcer person said, well, it's a false hope. He said, yes, perhaps, but it is a hope nonetheless.
Hmm.
And that's the best he could come up with.
Now, talk a bit about the experience, because I'm looking right at the photocopy of the Miracle Crusade Partner Pass for June 16th, 2005 mm-hmm. in Detroit.
Yes, right down the street.
Of the Miracle Crusades that you attended, you said that the standard claim is, well, these miracles that attract people, wow people, so that the message of the gospel would have credibility with the listeners there. Using Benny Hinn as an example, did he preach the gospel, the message of Jesus Christ, crucified and raised from the dead for the forgiveness of sins? Did he preach that with his miracles?
No, he did not. Benny did no preaching and teaching at any of the Miracle Crusades we attended or the ones that you can watch on his television program. He usually comes into a town on a Friday night and a Saturday. And Saturday morning, in our case, he trotted out an aging Rex Humbard, who I don't know if Rex is still alive or not, but he was very old a couple of years back. And Rex gave a standard Arminian kind of Billy Graham decision theology sort of gospel appeal, but he was singing to the choir. Everyone, the few, you know, 100 that got up and were there at 9 in the morning, were already Christians. I don't remember seeing too many, if maybe a handful of people, you know, in quotes, walking the aisle and coming down front to say the sinner's prayer. But Benny himself, he does not preach or teach in these meetings. He does raise money for his ministry. And he does tell about how, the Lord has sent me here. There's a tremendous anointing here tonight. And at the end of the Saturday meetings, he'll look into the camera and say, I'm coming next to you, Cleveland. And I've already seen in prayer that God is going to do wondrous things. You know, you don't want to miss it. And he always, you know, pumps up the next meeting. But no, he doesn't do any preaching during these meetings. None at all. Not the gospel as we understand it. He does ask for money, and he will cite certain scriptures about giving, but he does not do any biblical preaching or teaching. And he did so as a pastor. I mean, we've got series of his tapes where he does teach on different topical messages from the Bible, but not during these crusades.
We're talking with Bob Leko. He's co-founder of Discernment Ministry International, based in Detroit. He's authored an article in the latest Truth Matters newsletter titled, Do Miracles, Signs, and Wonders Create Faith? Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're coming to you live this Wednesday, the 27th of September. And our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Bob, it is also claimed, and I think this seems to be one of those foundational claims that's common to the charismatic fringe and the Pentecostal movement, that God is in the business in these latter days of raising up miracle workers, raising up training miracle workers for these latter days. Is this claim true?
No, it's not a true claim, but it's one that is made. And again, in the article, as I stated, it's all of this is really founded on faulty presuppositions, and it goes way back to the holiness movement of the 1800s and then the alleged outpouring of the Holy Spirit at Azusa Street in 1906. And people believed, well, if God is restoring the vocal gifts such as tongues and prophecy, and the holiness people already believed in divine healing, which again, we believe Jesus heals today, we're not denying that. But they added then tongues and verbal direct prophecy along with healing. Well, then it logically seemed to fit that, well, if he's restoring these sign gifts back to the church, people made the jump illogically, but they made the jump to saying, well, then he must also be restoring apostles and prophets. And if he's restored tongues and prophecy, well, another gift, of course, was the working of miracles. So it shouldn't be out of the ordinary then for someone to rise up and say that God has given me this gift. Just like we've received the gift of other tongues, He has given me the gift of the working of miracles. Come out to my miracle tent and receive your healing or deliverance or whatever miracle you need. And you know, don't have any doubts, because as we know, God is no respecter of persons. You know, if he healed one person, he'll heal you too, if you have faith. And so that's how the whole thing got started. And, you know, it traces way back to the early 1900s and has gone on from there. And we had, of course, famous people like Amy Simple McPherson, who started the Foursquare Church. We've got, of course, Catherine Kuhlman, who was Benny Hinn's mentor in a way. And we end up with people like Benny on TV and Peter Popoff and Robert Tilton and a variety of these people that claim to have the gift of working of miracles. And yet, for all the years of ministry and all the, you know, 12 times a year, well, more than that, 12, let's see, I don't know how many hundreds of miracle crusades Benny Hinn has held, but he should have stacks of documentation of healings and miracles, but he doesn't. He can't provide evidence for 6 or 7 people that have received a divine healing, deliverance, or any type of miracle after years of holding these crusades that are standing room only, turning away hundreds and thousands of people. And it's just amazing to me that people would continue to support and follow men and women who make these claims and yet can't back them up with any independent, verifiable evidence. I mean, Jesus himself said when he would cleanse a leper, you know, go show yourself to the priest, you know, as commanded by the law. In other words, hey, if something has happened, let it be verified, let it be proven. And yet these guys can't prove anything. We just take it on faith that these things are happening.
Charles is calling from his car. Charles, thanks for being patient and welcome.
Yeah, thanks, gentlemen, for your comments. Appreciate it. I would like to take the question out of the context of the charismatic movement and just throw in on Jesus and his miracles and his healings. You had mentioned earlier that the gospel presentation, generally speaking, came first and then the healings afterwards. Can you then delineate the verification of the purpose for which Jesus did the miracles and his healings?
Excellent question, Charles. Thank you very much. So if the charismatic fringe does not have it right on the purpose of signs, wonders, and miracles, what did Jesus, what were the miracles for?
I think that the fact that Jesus did these things proved who he was. In fact, even with the unbelieving Pharisees and Sadducees at one point, and I'm sorry, I don't have my Bible in front of me open, but he said, look, you know, if you're not going to believe my teaching, then at least believe me, you know, believe who I'm saying, who I am, the Christ, the Son of the living God, you know, by the signs that I'm doing. Because nobody had ever done the signs that Jesus had done, such as opening the blind man's eyes. You know, they asked his parents, and then finally they asked him, and it's like, you know, nothing like this has been done in Israel before, and that's one of the reasons that the Pharisees really began to plot against Jesus, because the people were seeing these things and were beginning to believe that, yes, this man indeed may in fact be the Messiah that has been promised to us. So he backed up his words with his deeds, and those deeds pointed back to the fact that he was indeed God in the flesh.
And I would add to that, Charles, we cannot discount the fact that Jesus did these miracles, especially the healings and the casting out of demons and all this kind of stuff, because he genuinely cared for those who were in distress.
Yes.
And
yes,
this is part and parcel of his very character and who he is. And I would add one other thing, and that is all of them should for us stand as a foreshadowing of his greatest sign and miracle of all, his resurrection from the dead. They're all a prelude to the miracle by which he saves us all.
Absolutely. And another thing I think that would be interesting for your listeners to consider is if they would simply make a list from Genesis to Revelation, just kind of fingering through the Bible, they're going to come up with an extremely short list of people that God used to work miracles in the Bible. There are not a whole lot of people that worked miracles, and yet people like Marilyn Hickey and others teach from the book of Acts, they make it seem as though miracles were everyday occurrences, that every believer was now empowered and equipped to go out, and they were just working miracles left and right. And that simply is not the case. We see the apostles working miracles. We see a couple examples of people that the apostles appointed specifically and empowered by the direction of God, to such as Stephen, to go out and work, you know, if you will, a few signs and wonders. But just the average believer was not out there working miracles. There's nothing in church history, recorded church history, that says this is to be expected as common everyday Christianity. And if your church is not having, you know, signs, wonders, and miracles in every service, then God's power is obviously not there, and you're just, you know, dead and have a form of religion without the power. And they've lost the very words of Paul, where Paul said, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. Why? Because it is the power of God unto salvation, unto everyone who believes. The gospel is the power of God, not Benny Hinn. It's not even someone's eyes being opened, as wonderful as that might be, or a cripple walking, as wonderful as that may be. If that person has not heard the gospel and believed the message, and through that, God generating faith in their heart, they've come to trust in Christ and Him alone, then their open eyes, their walking, their whatever, is worthless, because they're still going to end up in hell. And so, you know, the primacy, I think, of miracles and the power of God is found in the gospel and in the faithful preaching and teaching of it.
Then, Bob, finally, with only about 30 seconds here, it sounds as though the charismatic fringe and its great advocates are looking at Jesus' ministry and majoring in minors. They are forgetting to do the one thing that is absolutely needful, and they're spending their time drawing people's attention to those things, false as they are, which are not the point of why Jesus came to be our Savior.
Absolutely. It's kind of reminds me of when Jesus rebuked the Pharisees and said, hey, you guys are great. You know, you're tithing of mint and rue and all of these little minutiae, but you're forgetting the major things of compassion and mercy and justice. You know, those are the things you ought to be majoring on. Well, today I would say, hey, guys, what you need to be majoring on is preaching the gospel, knowing, first of all, what it is, and then preaching it to God's people. And then if God decides to sovereignly have any type of sign or wonder follow that preaching, then wonderful.
Bob Leko is co-founder of Discernment Ministry International, based in Detroit. He's authored this article in the latest Truth Matters newsletter, Do Miracle Signs and Wonders Create Faith? You can check out the website for Discernment Ministry International. Go to ours, issuesetc.org. I'll get it out. Click links and you'll find a direct link to Bob Leko and Discernment Ministry International. Bob, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Well, thank you, sir.
Well, tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll visit the subject of signs and wonders, and we'll talk with a Signs and Wonders teacher, Marilyn Hickey. We'll be right back.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues Etc.